It is Wednesday, March 29th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Britain begins the process that will trigger Brexit.
This is an historic moment from which there can be no turning back.
Arab leaders discuss the crises facing their region at an Amman summit, and we look back at the career of rock and roll legend Chuck Berry. It's all ahead. British Prime Minister Theresa May Wednesday triggered Article 50, beginning 2 years of negotiations of a lengthy and complex process of ending 4 decades of engagement with the European Union. Article 50 of the EU's treaty covers how a member can withdraw. The breakup began with a June 2016 referendum in which British voters narrowly chose to leave the EU. I spoke with Quentin Peel, an associate fellow of the Europe program at the London-based think tank Chatham House. I asked him how the process will work.
We're now at the beginning of a 2-year process to try and negotiate this exit from the European Union. It's going to be a fantastically challenging exercise. This is the most complicated negotiation that certainly the British government has undertaken in peacetime, I would think, ever. And it's like, as one former European official said last week, trying to get an egg out of an omelette. It's going to cost the egg and it's going to cost the omelette. It's going to be very difficult. And to be honest, I'll be very surprised if they succeed.
Is it known yet how this will impact Britain's economy?
There are a lot of people who are worried that the effect will be first from uncertainty, continuing uncertainty until we know the outcome. People will put off making investment decisions and put off really employing more people. But at the same time, there are quite a lot of financial institutions and big businesses who are looking very seriously at moving jobs out of the UK and onto the European continent. Those are the negative aspects. The people who want to leave the European Union, and they were a majority in the British referendum, they, of course, say, oh, it's all going to be fantastic. We'll be liberated from Europe. We can trade with the world. It will go very well. I'm afraid most economists think that's wrong.
Now, you said a bit earlier that this might not even happen, that Brexit might not even take place. Is that possible?
No, what I was more saying is I believe that there could be no deal at the end of 2 years, and they will then have to decide, do they carry on negotiating to try and get a deal, or do they just accept that they crash out, there is no agreement, and that in fact could go down very badly inside the United Kingdom, because the Scottish might very well vote for independence, saying no deal with Europe is a disaster for us all. So Theresa May is really caught between her 27 European partners on the one side and the Scottish, the Northern Irish, a lot of people in Britain. They may be a minority, but who are very unhappy at the prospect of a bad deal with Europe.
Well, I believe just yesterday the Scottish Parliament voted to have an independence referendum. Is it known when that will happen?
No, it isn't, and for two reasons. One, Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister in Scotland, who wants the referendum, says we won't call it until we know what the Brexit deal is, i.e. is it a good or a bad deal. On the other hand, Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, who's after all the Prime Minister for Scotland as well, says she won't give the go-ahead for a referendum until maybe years down the line when we've all learnt to live with Brexit.
Quentin Peel, an associate fellow of the Europe program at Chatham House, a London think tank. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, what's happening?
Well, a scary scene literally blocks from where we are here at the Voice of America headquarters today, where an erratic driver almost hit a Capitol Police officer who then opened fire. That driver was taken into custody. This was something that was trending across social media, especially in light of the attack on London and the Parliament there. Questions swirling about terrorism. Was this another attack using a car? Thankfully, it does not appear to be terror, but rather criminal-related, according to spokespeople from the U.S. Capitol Police, but still something that was trending across the country today, as many people were wondering and speculating about what happened there. The other big story trending today, as we just heard about, is Brexit and Article 50. A number of news agencies on social media carrying British Prime Minister Theresa May's speech to the House of Commons announcing the inaction or the acting Article 50. Many people pointing out that during the campaign that Theresa May was in the stay camp, and there's a lot of pictures swirling on social media of her with the Remain sign, holding up the Remain sign, so anything can be pulled up on social media just to show.
Be careful.
Yes. The other big viral video is EU President Donald Tusk, his statement where he said, "What can I say? We already miss you." A lot of people sharing that video. And then also a lot of the questions swirling about this Article 50 and what this means. Some holding out hope that Brexit won't happen. There's even an online petition to stop the move. Not clear how much good that'll do. A lot of others saying today the UK takes hold of its destiny, and there's a lot of excitement about that. And then there's a lot of concern about the UK and the future of the EU, rumors that Northern Ireland could leave the UK and join the EU, and as we just heard in that report, questions about the new Scottish independence referendum. So a lot of questions yet to be answered about this as Article 50 goes into effect. And as we saw across social media as well, the countdown clock, 730 days until the Brexit deadline. A lot of people saying it's the longest countdown clock on social media they've ever seen. But those 730 days are going to bring a lot of questions and a lot of answers being sought across social media.
Yeah, we'll have to stay tuned for that. Thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Pelshevsky. Here are some of the top news stories trending. A report says North Korea is increasing activity at its nuclear test site. As we just heard, a driver is detained after hitting a Capitol Police car. The United States ambassador says the UN is helping the corrupt government in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And the First Lady of the United States presents the International Women of Courage Award. Expanded coverage of these stories is on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Investigations by a team of paleontologists found 21 tracks made by different species of dinosaurs along a 25-kilometer area of coastline in northwestern Australia they've called Australia's Jurassic Park. Among the tracks are also what is considered to be some of the largest dinosaur tracks ever documented. The researchers say that some of the footprints made by members of a dinosaur group called the sauropod are around 1.7 meters long. Among the tracks include those from five different types of predatory dinosaurs, six from herbivorous sauropods, four from two-legged herbivorous ornithopods, and six types of tracks from armored dinosaurs. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, an investigation into the deaths of civilians in Mosul, Iraq. The leaders of 21 Arab states examine the conflicts and crises facing their countries and the region as the 28th Arab League summit officially got underway Wednesday in the Jordanian capital, Amman. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
Jordan's King Abdullah II was applauded after he delivered the keynote address to fellow Arab heads of state at the 28th Arab League summit in Amman. He underscored the major crises and conflicts plaguing the Arab world, including terrorism, the Palestinian issue, and the bloody conflicts in Syria, Libya, Iraq, and Yemen. فالإرهاب يهددنا نحن العرب والمسلمين أكثر مما يهدد غيرنا وضحايا الإرهاب أكثرهم. He says that terrorism represents above all a threat to the Muslim world and that Arab leaders must join efforts with others to resolve the problem. King Abdullah urged everyone to work to help alleviate the refugee crisis undermining the Arab world. Arab League Secretary General Ahmed Abul-Ghait stressed that one of every two refugees in the world is an Arab, and he deplored the inability of Arab leaders to put an end to the conflicts besetting the region.
وجدت أن الملفات الأهم ليست في حوزتنا أو ضمن قدرتنا على التأثير.
He says the most important issues and conflicts facing the Arab world, unfortunately, are not matters in the leaders' hands, such as Syria and Libya, and they are forced to sit back and watch. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who was a guest of the summit, deplored the refugee crisis that has created anguish, condemning waves of populism across the globe, causing developed countries to close their borders to refugees. He added that disagreements among Arab leaders make resolving conflicts more difficult.
Divisions in the Arab world have opened the door to foreign intervention and manipulation, breeding instability, sectarian strife, and terrorism.
European Union Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini was also a guest of the summit, telling Arab leaders they must work together.
Our common region is going through years of suffering, and peace and reconciliation can only come through a truly collective and cooperative approach.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi said he believes the only way to tackle terrorism is to attack its root causes. He says that in addition to a military component, terrorism also must be attacked on social, cultural, economic, and religious levels with the help of religious institutions. Lebanese President Michel Aoun painted a somber picture of the current situation in the Arab world, underscoring the need to break out of the bloody impasse. Aoun says he wishes he could discuss the achievements and progress being made in the Arab world, but the sounds of explosions and visions of death are overwhelming all other considerations. He says the Arab world is awash with war, massacres, destruction, death, and bloodshed. He asks who has won the war and who has lost it. Everyone has lost and everyone is a victim. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The senior U.S. commander in Iraq, Lieutenant General Stephen Townsend, acknowledged Tuesday a U.S. airstrike may have played a role in the killing of dozens of civilians in a West Mosul neighborhood March 17th.
If we did it, and I'd say there's at least a fair chance that we did, it was an unintentional accident of war, and we will transparently report it to you when we're ready.
In a video conference with reporters from Baghdad, Townsend said an investigation is underway to determine whether the attack might have set off a large explosion from explosives set by Islamic State militants inside a building nearby. An Iraqi military spokesman said militants detained about 130 civilians in a house, deployed snipers, and brought in an explosives-laden truck and parked it next to the house and was targeted by an airstrike. UN Human Rights spokesman Rupert Colville denounced the IS tactic of using civilians as targets of coalition attacks.
This is an enemy that ruthlessly exploits civilians to serve its own ends and has clearly not even the faintest qualm about deliberately placing them in danger.
But he called on coalition forces to review their tactics to avoid civilian loss of life and the impact of operations on the civil population. Washington Institute for Near East Policy Distinguished Fellow James Jeffrey tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, U.S. forces have confronted these kinds of militant attacks in the past.
We had two of them in Kunduz, you'll remember, in Afghanistan over the past year and a half, where extensive investigations were done. And this goes all the way back to the first Iraq war, where we hit a bunker that was full of people. Three things. One is we need to get the actual facts out. I trust the U.S. military to be honest and to be complete, and this research. Secondly, we need to realize that the problem of all of this is ISIS. By its holding the entire population hostage, by fighting in built-up areas with the civilian population, not allowing the population to flee, it is the real factor behind this. Three, I am absolutely sure that if this was an incident caused by coalition aircraft, it was a mistake. It was also a very rare mistake. We've had a few incidents in the last few weeks. What's unusual is we have had almost none since the summer of 2014 when we started these aircraft attacks. We're being very, very careful. But now we're in the last stages of the fight against ISIS. It should go quickly because the longer millions of people, and there's still millions of people, are under ISIS control, the more the horrors will continue. And when you're fighting with ISIS with its back to the wall in populated areas, it's going to be hard, unless you give up fighting them, not to sooner or later have an incident like this.
How critical are these airstrikes to back up the Iraqi ground forces?
They will not succeed in close city combat without airstrikes. ISIS has had too long to dig in. For example, what they do is ISIS has an extraordinary number of trucks, heavily armored and loaded with thousands of pounds of explosives that can just drive into Iraqi columns. So what we do is we basically isolate the Iraqi column by blowing big holes in the roads and such, while also trying to hunt the trucks themselves or find garages and other things where they might be. So a lot of this is focused on these IED trucks.
That's James Jeffrey of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. At least 61 bodies have been pulled from the rubble of the building that collapsed, far lower than the 200 or so casualties reported a few days ago. The UN on Tuesday said more than 300 civilians have been killed in Mosul since mid-February. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. As tributes continue to pour in following the death of pop music founding father Chuck Berry, who died on March 18th at the age of 90. VOA Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald tells VOA's Jim Stevenson why Chuck Berry was so revered.
We have lost one of the greats, Chuck Berry.
Chuck was a huge favorite of mine. His songs were so witty. That's what I always loved about them. They were funny, they were perceptive, and then, of course, he was a great guitar player and songwriter, and he created what we think of as rock and roll. I think of him as the father of rock. Elvis was the first rock star, but Chuck put the building blocks in place. And what I want to talk about today is what made Chuck Berry Chuck Berry. He passed away, of course, on March 18th. He was 90 years old, and tributes have been pouring in from all over the world about his artistry. But what about Chuck Berry the man? Well, he was a complicated person. And I think a lot of that sprang from his upbringing. He was born in Missouri in 1926 into a segregated society. As a teenager, he spent 3 years in reform school, and he worked as a beautician before he seriously got into music in the 1950s. And when Chuck really got rolling in the mid to late 50s, he was already in his 30s. He was a good 10 years older, for instance, than Elvis or some of his other early rock contemporaries. So that was a differentiating factor. He also was a great observer of American life at all levels. He sang about teenage life, and he sang with no accent So it was very clear to people what he was singing about. And he had a style that translated and traveled well, which is why people across the country and across the Atlantic, in England especially, really took to his stuff. And he became the mentor for an entire generation of white rock heroes like the Beatles, the Beach Boys, and the Rolling Stones. But this developed into a situation where they were actually ripping him off. He successfully sued the Beach Boys for ripping off his song Sweet Little 16 and their song Surfin' USA. His manager brought a copyright infringement against John Lennon for the Beatles song Come Together, which incorporated elements of Chuck's song You Can't Catch Me. That was settled out of court. So Chuck was very ambivalent about the rock stars who praised him because, you know, they were taking money from him. Mm-hmm. And his career had been derailed in the late 50s when he was imprisoned for 20 months for taking an underage girl across state lines for what were deemed immoral purposes. Chuck's glory years were from about 1955 to 59. After he got out of prison, he began recording again, and he encountered some success. And his one and only U.S. number one single, My Ding-a-Ling, came out in 1972. But these were just footnotes. I mean, Chuck Berry is remembered for the genius songs that he wrote in the 1950s.
They say sometimes imitation is the most sincerest form of flattery, and certainly most artists did, in fact, imitate Chuck in some form or another throughout the years.
They sure did.
Well, Ray, we are so thrilled to have you with us each and every week. Our Top 20 Countdown host, you can hear Ray at VOA1 and also follow him on Twitter.
Ray on the hits.
Thanks so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
Any old time you use it, it's got to be rock and roll music. If you want to dance with me, if you want to dance with me.
The music of Chuck Berry. Well, that's our show. Please remember to visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Human rights abuses continue to be a serious problem in Russia, according to the latest State Department human rights report. The continuing occupation and so-called annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula affects the human rights situation significantly and negatively. The Russian government continued to train, equip, and supply pro-Russian forces in eastern Ukraine, who were joined by numerous fighters from Russia. Credible observers attributed thousands of civilian deaths and injuries as well as widespread abuses to Russian-backed separatists in Ukraine's Donbas region and to Russian occupation authorities in Crimea. Russian authorities also conducted politically motivated arrests, detentions, and trials of Ukrainian citizens in Russia, many of whom claimed to have been tortured. Human rights groups asserted that numerous Ukrainian citizens remained in Russia as political prisoners. Within Russia itself, authorities restricted citizens' ability to choose their government through free and fair elections, and increasingly instituted a range of measures to suppress dissent. The government of President Vladimir Putin passed repressive laws and selectively employed existing ones to harass, discredit, prosecute, imprison, detain, fine, and suppress individuals and organizations critical of the government. Amendments to anti-terrorism laws granted Russian authorities additional powers that were also used to suppress and harass activists and critics of Mr. Putin's policies. Authorities especially targeted individuals and organizations that profess support for the government of Ukraine or oppose the Russian government's activities in Ukraine. The Russian government continued to target civil society. According to the Human Rights Report, authorities further stymied the work of non-governmental organizations, or NGOs, through the Foreign Agents and Undesirable Foreign Organization laws. Authorities also significantly expanded the definition of political activities to bring more NGOs under the foreign agents category. Authorities began fining NGOs for not disclosing foreign agent status, while courts closed NGOs for violations involving the foreign agents list. Under the expanded definition of political activities, authorities added environmental and HIV prevention organizations to the list. Promoting human rights and democratic governance is a core element of U.S. foreign policy, said U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. The human rights reports demonstrate the United States' unwavering commitment to advancing liberty, human dignity, and global prosperity around the world, including in Russia.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.